What we'd like to do is go around the room and give everybody a chance to speak about why they're here and what they hope to get out of the training, because that will help us. And I also think it will help you crystallize in your mind what you hope to get out of here, and it will help the whole group come to what we call group mind. You know, we'll see what everybody wants and we'll see what people hope to accomplish here. And I think that will help facilitate the process, frankly. So the other thing is I'd like to impose a one-minute restriction on how long people speak, 1 minute being the longest, for two reasons. One, just to get used to the idea that the clock in a meeting is an ally, that if you set it as a structure to help guide you, then it tends to make the meeting move more smoothly because people know that they have a certain amount of time and they know that at a certain point the meeting is going to end. And so it sort of crystallizes the energy toward finishing what needs to be accomplished. And also to give people a sense of how long a minute is. It's actually quite a long time.
So there's 17 people, which means 17 minutes. And the other piece about doing 1 minute is being really conscious. If you go over your time, it is a question about democracy of the group. You're actually taking someone else's time and space, so being that conscious of time. So which way do we want to start?
Are we going to ring a bell?
I don't think you need to ring a bell. I think I would, at 45 seconds, I'll do this. And at a minute, you know, then we have people out in the hall who come in and just take you away.
That was not consensed upon by the group. That was just imposed.
That was just a joke, actually. So, okay, so why don't we start here to the left, if that's all right.
Okay. I'm Stuart, and I am active mainly with the Direct Action Network. I've been involved with consensus decision-making a bunch over the last 2 years, and I just see it as an incredibly powerful tool for people to be able to come together and to allow different voices to be heard and expressed, while at the same time people are actually finding ways that they can be effective together. And I just want to see how far this tool can be pushed, which could be very, very far. It should be great.
My name is Diana Jarvis. I first got involved in the anti-WF protest as a legal observer for when the Dravos, which is obviously no longer the Dravos Convention, came to New York. And I've met a great group of people, and I find this form of direct democracy to be very, very interesting because I'm accustomed to very hierarchical structures. I'm used to seeing people come up with very much categorized speakers as to who is the most important or who has the most at stake here or who is the one who has the most power to make everyone else do it and structure the conversation usually around that. And it's interesting to see a situation where people are deliberately trying to construct the opposite. It's actually very rare. And it's hard because, and I can see already that you're dealing with some of the problems, is that we are so trained to work in hierarchical structures that we unconsciously adopt the roles we are supposed to acquire. I mean, if you're younger, if you're female, if you're of color, you're more likely to be more hesitant in your talk, you're more likely to try to be more polite, you're more likely to try to pay attention. If you're more accustomed to thinking yourself privileged, you're much more accustomed to believing you can easily dominate the conversation. And I've seen this happen so much in natural conversations when people simply talk. It's interesting to see people come up with a structure deliberately designed to counteract that.
I'm Fred. I'm not sure what the question is, but I'll try to answer what I think it is. I think that any group has dynamics, and the dynamics of the group is determined by what the dominant culture is in that group, unfortunately. And that if the group is not mindful of the smaller part of the participants, then eventually become a homogenized group which is not inclusive and which is bound to fail. So I'm trying to see if there is anything better in the hierarchical, that can work.
My name is David, and I'm here because WBAI is trying to come up with some new bylaws, this democracy that there's a judge in California who made to save the station, otherwise it would belong to corporations. and it'd be gone, you wouldn't have even listened to it. Maybe they'd sell the station. We're trying to come up with some new structure and new bylaws, and there's so many different directions. Some people are very interested in diversity and guaranteeing that we have X number of this and X number of that people running the thing on the board. Other people, like myself, are interested in trying to prevent this from happening again, when we get taken over, infiltrated. And a little training like this would be very helpful because we have these different directions going in our meetings.
My name's Jim. I work with Modern Times Club with Dan, Awip, and Students for the Peace Society. And the first time that I saw consensus-based decision-making was at April 16th in D.C. against the IMF and World Bank. And, not that much. But at least the knowledge of the movement. And I just walked into this huge room, hundreds and hundreds of people there, and everybody was being, pretty respectful, and people were, I had a clear line of who was speaking, and nobody was cutting each other off, and there was no competition in the meeting of who to talk, who gets to talk, and there was no nobody trying to sway anybody to do what they wanted to do, and I thought it was really amazing, because I felt that in a movement that was trying to change the world, we should all give an example of what and how it could be better, and I think that facilitation is a big way, and consensus actually is a big way of getting to that better world.
I'm Megan, and I've worked with Modern Times, and now that I've moved into the city, I'm going to be working with Dan and AWIP and also Students for a Free Society. I guess I'm basically here because, I always feel I have something more to learn, and I think this is a great thing to learn to help spread to other people and
My name is David. I've been working for a couple of years now with Dan and AWIP, ACC, other groups, and I've always found consensus really inspiring. I'm as an anthropologist, which is what I do for a living, I just find it ethnographically fascinating because I first actually experienced consensus decision-making in Madagascar. And it's only really when I came to see formal process that I understood a lot of what I'd seen there. Especially what I want to get out of the training, I think the more that we sort of think about and check what it is we're doing, the more we can spread it to others, and I think that's incredibly important.
My name is Mike. I'm with the New York City Independent Media Center, and I do most of my work with the paper we have there, The Independent. And I think we're struggling right now we all want to use consensus and direct democracy in running the paper, but we've found it extremely hard to work on a publication on using consensus models. And I'm hoping, to get some ideas at this meeting today as to how we can improve doing that.
My name is Richard. I work with Students for Free Society, Queens College, and the CUNY for All Coalition. I'm mainly a CUNY organizer, but just recently they installed 20 video cameras in my building, and they're not renting out apartments to Latino families anymore, and there's all sorts of harassment and threats going on. So I called a meeting for Monday, and that's why I'm here, so I can better facilitate that meeting.
Hi, my name is Yixi, and I'm from Taiwan, and I'm going back to Taiwan after school. Like Diane said, I'm female, and I'm still young, and I'm colored, and I'm here to learn how to beat the privilege that I don't have.
Hi, my name's Phil. I came here, because since the World Economic Forum protests, I've kind of been kicking around the periphery of the AWIP activities and stuff like that, and I'm kind of becoming more and more involved in sort of considering what our government, what big business is doing, and where it's leading our lives, kind of seemingly without having any control over where that's going. So it's I think it's important to kind of start to participate on a lot of levels, in our society, and you know, kind of, I guess, from a sort of grassroots, sort of street level, I came here hoping to get some information to be used to kind of like further, just kind of like standing up against like corporations, standing up against government, you know, to kind of like help organize and continue struggles and whatnot in the city and wherever else I might be later on.
I'm Courtney, and in the other movements that I've studied, I've seen how the momentum was broken through, and how that doesn't work. And then with the World Economic Forum was the first time that I actually saw it, and saw it work. And so I'm just going to learn more.
Hi, I'm Luis, and I'm here for two reasons. One, as I spoke up before, just on an interpersonal level, I think it's really important to be a better democratic listener, as well as not only for giving more respect to people that I'm involved with, but also to receive respect. And I think it sounds like this model is a really good way to go about that. I'm also involved, I was involved with the WEF protests, and sort of have some of my own groups who are starting up, and I just really think it's important that it is something where everyone has a consensus. So here I am.
I'm Lauren. I come at this very new. I found out about this almost coincidentally, and I thought from the name of it, it sounded great. And just going around and listening, hearing people's experiences and people's ideas, it makes me that much more optimistic about what I imagine it may be, but don't really know, and I'm here to find out.
My name's Rachel, and I have been active in the Green Party in the city for the last 7 years. We try to run our meetings by consensus, but it takes time to learn what that means, and to have, we have a sort of rudimentary consensus process, but there's not always agreement on what that means. And what I've noted, I mean, when I first went to a Green Party meeting, I wasn't that familiar with consensus and what it means, and I noticed that as we've been growing and more people come in, a lot of people are not familiar with consensus and how it works. And so I would like to learn how to explain it better and learn more about it myself. I heard people say they went to meetings of Direct Action Network, and the meetings went really well. They were really impressed, so I wanted to come and learn.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a Korean-American, and I'm involved with several different organizations, some Korean-American groups and some peace groups. And I mean, used to, you know, like making decisions through, you know, by majority vote and so on. But I think maybe this consensus decision process may be more helpful in the you know, some other ways. So I'm here to learn, try to learn the skills.
My name is Diego. I'm from Uruguay, and I recently moved to this country, and I really want to participate in democratic life of, you know, how things are run. I like to have a say how, you know, my tax money is spent as well. And I think also on a personal level, it's very important to be able to listen and take in and participate. So I hope that it's going to help today.
My name is Petra, and I'm with Dan and a variety of other groups, and Autonomy Media Press. And this is my second time doing this workshop, and the first time was learning a lot about the structural aspect of consensus, and seeing it now practiced on a regular basis in the Dan meetings and with recent WEF thing. And now this time I'm interested in learning more, as other people were saying, about interpersonal relationships, because I find it really hard working with other people because people don't really have positions or places or defined roles there doesn't seem to be any responsibility around how they interact or even communicate or do anything. So everything is like way more difficult than it is working under a structured basis of authoritarian structure. And I want to listen and see if I can get some tips on how we can, or how I can relate differently to people so I, when I'm working, I can get something done.
My name is Robert, and past year and a half I've been a so-called Pacifican when the Save Pacifica movement. Currently, people that are active in trying to develop some sort of democratization based generally on a representational democracy. And there's a lot of discord. That's why I say so-called Pacifican, because there's just an awful lot of discord among the strangers who have come together and tried to work together. And about a year ago, I experienced consensus at a indie media meeting, sat in on their organizational process, and I was very impressed. It was a much younger crowd than the general Pacifica crowd, and to me, that it seemed like a much more mature meeting than I've ever experienced in a Pacifica setting. And it also, the anthropologist made me think that meeting reminded me of a Native American process. So I walked away from sitting in on their organizational meeting awestruck, really. So I'd like to find out more about this process.
Likewise, my name is Beth Oram, and I've been increasingly politicized since Seattle. And I've been somewhat disturbed by sort of, I'm impressed by what I see as the broad outlines of a truly amazing movement with tremendous potential, but somewhat distressed by the degeneration of that movement sort of into single issue interest group kind of politics. What is your issue? Is it globalization? Is it environmentalism? Is it Israel? What is it? But essentially, I think that the core of the movement that I see developing is democracy, period, pure and simple, local, global, personal. And I think this is where it starts, and I want to learn more about that process. I think this is our opportunity to reclaim that process. I think there are two kinds of relationships in the world. There are personal and political relationships, and there's a whole wall of books at Barnes & Noble about the personal relationships and how we should do them. And nobody teaches us about how to relate to each other politically. And until we start to learn how to do that, we're not going to be able to organize effectively. And also, as a child of the 60s, I have a lot to learn from young people, because those meetings were run in a shockingly hierarchical and sexist fashion. And any of us who come from, you know, organizing in the 60s and 70s need to completely relearn that. So that's it.
Now, a couple of people came in late, so we're doing introductions. Give me a minute to talk about why you're here and what you hope to get from the meeting.
Okay, I think that was the next time. My name is Antina. I'm originally from Germany, and I've been here for a couple of years now. And I was involved in Germany in a few groups, and I think precisely the problem with them was that they ended up consciously or unconsciously being hierarchical. So that created somewhat of a frustration. And I've been to a couple of consensus meetings, but I'm here to learn the intricacies and understand better what's going on.
My name is Ramsey, and I've been involved with Dan for quite a while now. I love to learn more about consensus and run some of the meeting democratically. I know most of the people here, but I never run the meeting, so maybe coming to here, learning how to run the meetings, to be able to facilitate one of the meetings. So, yeah.
I'm Natalie. I'm ditto for Dan. and also, I reflect having been in many organizations that ran on a hierarchical basis. It's time to learn another way.
I'd just like to point out that nobody took more than 45 seconds. No, I think it's great just to see how much information you can get out. If you think about what you're going to say and speak to that and then fall silent, you know, you can really accomplish a lot in a short time.
So as far as going over from what people have said, and there's a lot, so we'll try to touch on everything or work it through, and the group will help us to do that. But what we've talked about as a tentative agenda for this meeting is to do what we just did, which is the go-around and introductions, and then to have a discussion on consensus, why consensus and direct democracy and the difference between consensus and majority rule. So we'll help facilitate that discussion and put into it, but part of that, the goal of that is to show that actually we know a lot more than we think we know. I think sometimes you go into training, you go, oh, I don't know very much about consensus, and we start having a conversation and we realize we actually know very little. And then to briefly go through a little bit of the history, which, you know, David talking about Madagascar and, you know, Seattle, different places where consensus has been used, where it comes from. And then to go through the formal process of, you know, consensus decision making as far as setting an agenda, and what's a block, what's a stand aside, all of that. Different roles in a meeting. A little bit of a discussion on times to use consensus and when maybe not to use consensus. Is it something that's, you know, that you write in stone and always use? And then techniques for facilitation, which has a whole number of pieces to it. Including lots of tools and things like that for listening. And, you know, if somebody starts to get really disruptive or there's some of this interpersonal stuff going on that Petra was talking about within a meeting, how do we facilitate that? How do we deal with that? And then taking a break. And then coming back, and we have a whole number of role plays, kind of different ranges of from, you know, coming up with a name to a group to all kinds of direct action role plays. So as we get closer to the role play part, we'll come up with suggestions and figure out what works for different small groups. So is that? That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. And we think it'll take about an hour and 20 minutes to get to the break. So if people feel they need a break before that, you know, obviously feel free to go ahead and take a break. If it gets a little hot, we can open the window. We opened it before, it got cold real fast. But, you know, we might as well say this right out. To me, one of the most important things about this is that facilitators are not the leaders. They're the guides. So this is our meeting. We're all going to learn how to facilitate better together. And believe me, I've facilitated some meetings where I've made really, really dumb mistakes, and I've learned from them. And that's just the nature of it. You can't go in there afraid that you might make mistakes, because everybody makes mistakes. And what I have found is that the group is invariably very supportive. There may be disagreements, but the facilitator is a person who they may say, hey, look, you know, this is what we have to do different, etc. But it's not personal. And so... Sure. My idea of consensus is something that I'd like to hold for a while and see what other people think. So let's take a show of hands. Not a show of hands. Let's hear what we call popcorn. When people think about consensus, what do they think about? You know, what is it that pops to mind?
A popcorn is essentially you don't raise your hand and go through a stack. It's a technique in consensus decision making. It's a technique just of having a conversation. So you shout out. It means collective. It means
like brainstorming, consensus. No?
Right. It's like brainstorming, right. But rather than going through us as the facilitators, people kind of like look around and just kind of shout out an idea or a brief sentence, not a long piece. It's a popcorn.
For example, unanimous? Is consensus always unanimous? What are some other thoughts on?
Majority.
Dialogue.
Your voice being heard.
Agreement. Speak up, please, everybody, because we're in a big room and we have sirens behind us.
Well, I guess one of the problems, the biggest problem I see with consensus is if people are not being genuine. If someone, for example, blocks and won't work with the group, and they are, you know, it. And possibly they are doing that from, let's say, an obstructionist position to try to block the group from taking action. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with people with that motivation?
I also think it's subject to coercion the other way, in the sense that people may simply sign off on something they don't really like because they don't care enough to block the person who has dominated the group. I mean, I think of African dictators who often say, we don't have democracy because we have consensus decision-making. I mean, consensus can also be a cover for some dictatorial point of view that nobody else is really in a position to want to go to the effort to change or challenge.
What do the Japanese do? We kept 10, 15 years ago, we read in the magazines and newspapers about how they never argued or they never voted or they just somehow kept talking until they came to a
consensus. As I understand it, I'm not a history major by any matter of means, but the Native Americans, the Iroquois who lived in this area, fashioned their democracy on consensus decision making, and they used that model. They were bringing people in and discuss it until they reach a decision. If people know more about that, I'd be happy to hear about it. But it's what I wrote down out of what we just heard was dialogue, being heard, and not necessarily unanimity, but everybody's voice being heard, so that people feel empowered to speak up and to know that they're important and that their voice is influencing the decision. Even if you don't directly see the influence in the outcome, you know that your point of view has been put into the mind of the group.
I like to see it as also a synthesis of the different points come out, and then rather than, like in majority rule where you vote, it's coming to something that works for everyone, so that everyone's voice gets heard. And when we talk about the process, how you actually do that structurally, it's a proposal and different ideas come out on that one idea, and you come up with a synthesis of all of the different points and voices.
If I could just say one thing, I think that it doesn't it, like when you talk about the Japanese model of the Native Americans, isn't it important that you start with shared values and that are agreed on in a very general sense and then go from there?
Well, a key component.
I mean, if you have a shared value system, a vision which the group agrees upon, and then you're going from that generality to specifics, it seems to me that would propel it. Is that?
Shared values, and I would also say people's willingness to change their mind, because the one situation which consensus would not work would be if people came determined on their point of view and unwilling to change it. And then all the consensus in the world, and you know, they would simply send whoever was more willing to change their mind would wind up agreeing with whoever was unwilling to change their mind. And it would subvert the process.
I think people who have similar ideas and a similar background or are going into something with a similar purpose, then consensus works more effectively. I don't think that's an absolute, though. I think all that you really need is a commitment to try to use consensus, which is the face-to-face dialogue, listening to each other, and trying to come up with a solution collectively to something. And having been, and a couple people talked about this, these huge meetings, whether it's April 16th or the World Economic Forum, and even though there was a similar background as far as protests, there were a lot of different ideas of what people wanted to see, and that the main commonality was going on in the smaller groups, the affinity groups, but in the larger meetings or the spokes councils, people from different backgrounds were able to come up with a synthesis of certain sorts. So it can happen. I think it is harder. But where it's really not possible is when you have, you know, people with totally counter positions. You know, you need to decide what to do with a forest, and there's a developer there who wants to chop it down, and there are environmentalists who actually want to keep the forest. And so that you're not going to come to a consensus in that situation, but that's more of an extreme.
I think one thing to keep in mind, I mean, you need the commitment to have consensus, but then look at the positive side at the other end of the equation. When you have majority rule, you have people who lose. It's a win-lose situation. And those losers are sometimes bad losers, and they'll say, all right, well, I lost. And then they'll immediately begin to plot, all right, now how can we win next time? And so that rather than having a group that has decided to move forward on a common course of action, you have a majority, and perhaps even a very small majority, trying to move forward, and you may have a nearly equal-sized minority trying, in a sense, to get their own way, even though they have temporarily accepted the results of the vote. So majority rule, while it's, you know, obviously a fairly effective way of governing people, it certainly does have some major problems. And, you know, I am excited about consensus because it seems to me to be an evolution that people can use in governing themselves.
This is a business of the Japanese just keep talking until finally something comes out. Myself, if I'd just be worn down by this. And I bet a lot of people, I mean, if you say, what the heck, I can't compete with these guys who talk all the time, you know.
So this is also, when we go through the agenda, we talk about the role of the facilitator. The role of the facilitator is to help and get guidance from the groups that you don't just talk and talk and talk, but to kind of help guide that talking and get a sense from the group of, you know, at what point do we want to stop talking and see if we can come to something that works for people even if it's not perfect. So would you?
I think this gentleman and then I saw Stuart. Robert, right?
We're doing a stack thing. So.
Well, yeah, informally, and we'll discuss, I mean, we're using techniques of facilitation even as we teach about it.
Kind of follow the process. One of the issues at the consensus meeting that I attended at the Indy Media, one of the issues that came up during that evening and something I'd like to learn more about, and somebody mentioned obstructionists, is that with it was a group of 15 people and we were shooting for unanimous consensus. I don't know what consensus means, but we were shooting for unanimity. And one of the issues was that if someone wanted to derail the process, they could hold out and be obstructionist. And if the dynamics were based on unanimity, that would give that person carte blanche
to
do so. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to, I'm very interested in how that might be fixed.
In doing this, just to kind of say that there's many different ways of kind of formal consensus, and different people have written, and we'll give websites and different addresses of book suggestions and things like that to read about consensus, but different people use consensus in different ways, and I think it's important for any group that's deciding to use consensus to decide what type of consensus they're going to use, and we've been struggling in Dan and still haven't resolved if we use two-thirds majority as a default or not, or three-quarters majority or whatever, but there's different techniques and different. You can use consensus and still in the very end, for example, come up with some kind of voting system. So there's all kinds of ways of using consensus and coming up with different processes so that doesn't happen.
I was going to say, in response to what this gentleman was saying about the talking and talking, I've noticed that there's, like Marina said, there are a lot of different ways of approaching consensus. And there's one model which I've never taken part in. But I always call it the 24-hour consensus model, which is the one where everybody has their say. No one is ever asked to sort of hurry up or anything like that. And then there are other models which have set times, and it's the kind of thing that Jim has been implicitly doing by talking about sort of the respectfulness of sticking to times, which actually do get around some of those issues. Some people choose the endless consensus model, the 24-hour model. You can have a meeting that literally goes on for a day and a half, and they have their reasons for doing it, but you don't want to be in those meetings all the time. And then, as part of the popcorn, two big terms that come up with for me when I think of consensus are groups and action. Because I think that it's about, consensus is about forming a group, and even a group that uses it is always kind of reforming itself. But it only really makes sense if you're talking about what the group is going to do. And so, I mean, we're talking about process a lot here, and process is always a concern, but if it's not focused on what you're going to do after the meeting, it all becomes kind of empty. And so that is really, really central. And I think, yeah, and part of why it often works so well.
Well, one thing I was just going to say that just related to the Japanese, whatever it is we're referring to, concept, unless somebody here really knows how the Japanese handle it or do it or the background, it's just not a great example, because if we compare it, their culture is so different, and everything they say is almost backwards to how we relate, that it just, I don't think it's relevant unless we know what that Japanese model is. Is that right, Jim?
Well, I think the other thing is that if you're doing consensus within constraints, a larger system where people are telling you what to do, it's really different. You know, if you're part of a corporation, they say this, you know, group has to come up with something by five or else. You know, it's not really consensus in the same sense as a free group of people doing voluntary association.
Right.
But, I mean, one thing, when people are asking about anthropological stuff, I think any society where you don't have that kind of coercive mechanism, a state which can force minorities to go along with majorities, ends up using some form of consensus. Because if you can't compel a minority to go along, the last thing you want to do is, like, say, okay, let's all have a public contest and see who loses. So the big thing, if you can't compel people, is to make sure that everybody consents.
I think now, because, and we'll continue this kind of good beginning discussion on consensus and majority rule, and we'll keep, as we go through the next few hours, talking about conceptualizing consensus and different ways of using it. One just last thing I wanted to throw in before we go to history is, for me, one of the most powerful things about consensus, and coming from groups that were hierarchical and everything else, is that it's a place where you can be an individual and part of a collective, so you don't lose your individuality and your own opinions. It doesn't become about individualism and like leadership and power in that way. So you're an individual, and it's not the bad individual. And you're part of a collective whole. And that, to me, has been the most powerful experience through consensus.
And if I may just add, as a white man, it's been really eye-opening and very rewarding for me to get involved in a consensus process, because it's really had me take a look at a lot of things that I had just never even thought about. And I think it, as a learning tool, consensus is very, very valuable.
So a little bit of history of kind of consensus decision-making and direct democracy. What is that? If people want to share a little bit, if they have some concrete examples, then we can share as well. Part of the intention of this is that a lot of us, or at least us who got radicalized around consensus and direct democracy from Seattle, kind of have this feeling like we started it and we didn't. So it's to break that down and then also to show that there's so many historical models and current models.
Sure. Are we talking about like models and sort of experiences with it, or actual historical, is it more personal experiences in the consensus process?
It could be. I was thinking historical, but
I have one quick thing to say that I was part of my first involvement with, I must have been with consensus. Well, it wasn't with consensus. It was with this group that was a collective that thought they practiced consensus when in fact they didn't. And when I left, I was always thinking something was wrong and it was really bad, and I was in a conflicting position there, and I kept wanting to speak out and have a voice. Anyways, then I left and I realized what consensus was about. But maybe you can, we can address at one point what it's like, what about these groups that think they're doing consensus and they're not.
Could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Well, the question is kind of facilitating a conversation around the history of consensus and direct democracy, where it's been used, or if you've had experiences with it as well that were good or not, and that might raise questions, like, again, this question of, I think, what it is. This power, this part,
yeah.
Is that it looks like consensus, but there's actually a small group dominating, just like with majority rule.
Got it. My first real, certainly, you know, there's times when you're working with people, be it your friends, regardless of what your goal is, where, you know, I've had friends where it just worked really well, and it's because we're both really open to, you know, respecting one another's opinions and ideas and fuel boundaries or whatever, but the most incredible, and I know it's been said before, example I saw was really during the WEF protests this year. There was a meeting at St. Mark's, and I'm not good at counting heads. I mean, there was like maybe 100 people there, and everyone was in a circle. Nobody was shouting over the other person. There was this amazing dynamic where everybody, you know, I'm kind of a shy person. I felt totally comfortable. If I had something to voice, I didn't feel like I would be disrespected or, what do you know, shut up, you know, and everyone was just so respectful, and it really impressed me, and really drew me to wanting to be more involved with groups like that, because I too, in the past, have been involved with political groups that were very, not intentionally, but, you know, just as the woman brought it before, you know, through patterns we learned, chauvinistic, or, you know, there was some power monger, you know, with the best of intentions, sort of, making it a little more difficult for everybody to have their input. So, yeah, I'm just really intrigued by that.
From time, you guys are facilitating this. From time to time, could you just sort of go over what you have done to facilitate this? Just because we're here participating in it, you know, how you.
Just like sort of like a comment, like, we just did this.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
That's a very good suggestion. One thing I'm doing is I'm keeping an eye on the clock, and it's now 1:02. And one thing I like to do is to let people know we're hoping to be out of here about 3:30, maybe 4:00. You know, we'll make that decision after we come back from the group from the break. We'll see. But just I like to put out the time for people so that everybody begins to own the meeting as far as how long it's going to last and how well it's progressing. So it's now 1:02, just so people who are, you know, are paying attention along with us, we can regulate our comments and such.
And some of what I've been doing is thinking conceptually about where what people's experience through the conversation has been with consensus, and it seems that people have experience in consensus decision making and want to get to questions, more technical questions of dealing with issues of power or things that might come up in a meeting or how to actually do it, like your question of what we're doing specifically rather than what it is. So through facilitating, trying to figure out where the group should go to put out as a proposal to the group, you know, is this kind of helping to direct a little bit or put out proposals for direction for the group? So, but as far as historical, people have talked about Native Americans in Spain. This is, I think, something people talk about, the anarchists in Spain who had these big spokes councils and used made decisions by having the face-to-face conversation and coming up with a consensus, which was even in a war situation, which is pretty amazing. I had an experience personally just kind of falling into a town by accident in Mexico that the people had taken over to get rid of a golf course that the government wanted to put in a golf course, and so they nonviolently got rid of their local government. We had these nightly meetings that were directly democratic, meaning everyone would speak. There was a microphone that went around. And there weren't formal consensus process in the sense of like the spokes councils or the larger meetings that we've seen around big actions. But it was the person facilitating kind of reiterating what they were hearing and trying to come up with decisions of what to do for the next day. So all kinds of ways
I think we have to segregate the situation like this, like, you know, we're fighting for, you know, the same goal and the same purposes with the same interest. And maybe the situation where people are together in a group and have different interests and different goals. I'm more interested in that part because I feel like you cannot win something that, you know, that important simply by having people, you know, you're talking about the single issue type thing. And there's really never a very big problem of consensus in those groups. The consensus problem is when you have people with totally different interests, and how do you get to that point where people say, yeah, this is what we're going to do. I have no idea how you do this, so I'm sorry.
And I think that's a good question. We're going to get into formal processes, you know, after this, but there is also no hard and fast answer to that. You know, these are processes, but people need to make them work. And there are some very good techniques, but it's not like there's a formula you can open up and say, well, this is how it works.
Well, one other thing is I think this may be what the 24-hour consensus model is about, is that if you have people with totally different goals, one of the things you do is talk and talk and talk and talk and talk till you get to a vision of what it is they want. Once you understand everything about them, you'll understand what their real concern is. When you get to the, when you discover what it is they're really worried about, and sometimes they don't even know themselves, you know, talking it all out, talking about every possible consequence, you get to the point where what they're really worried about. And then it's often quite a small point of sticking between the two parties, and then you can then accommodate each other's goals. But that's part of what the constant talking about is. You get everyone's fears, hopes, dreams, possibilities, and you discover what they're really worried about. And that's how you isolate it.
I love him for the commonality. I think that's part of like what is there in common. When we started out and did the go around, we could kind of see a piece of ourselves and what other people were saying. So kind of like finding a place where we meet other people in the room. Just one thing when you were asking about the what we're doing as we're thinking, trying to alternate gender. When people raise their hand to something else, when you're facilitating gender and power and people who are oppressed in different ways or more vulnerable different ways for different reasons, is something else a facilitator really needs to be conscious of doing as we go around.
Well, I guess in alignment with your comment, I mean, I'm sort of trying to bring this back to the Green Party, and the Green Party is trying to do so many different things. I mean, change the world on a global scale and bring people from many disparate backgrounds together. How do you do that? And your comment about, you know, well, sit down and talk. I mean, I guess part of the conclusion from that is it takes a tremendous amount of time, so that it takes, you know, to actually get lots of people to get together and change and learn from each other is a tremendous undertaking that takes a tremendous commitment from everybody to participate and to give the time to do it. And even if they do that, I mean, to talk about global change, you're talking about years of actually going through this sort of discussions with people. I guess that's one thing I think a lot of activists don't really realize. I mean, they have an idea of change that they want to see happen, and they just want, how do we get my vision implemented, you know, as soon as possible?
I think I appreciate that point a lot, and I think maybe to elaborate on that, you know, there's like, well, who's to judge, but, you know, there's more difficult ways, but ultimately what is a better way to do something? Like, George Bush says that a dictatorship would be easier, but, you know, we don't necessarily think that that's better. So, like, you know, again, to sort of, you know, in support of using consensus, you know, that's something to think about.
Should we have two hands in history?
My sense is that Marina and Jim had some stuff prepared about the history of consensus, and I'd actually love to hear it.
That's actually was my comment. I might be really hopelessly old-fashioned, but I like to be lectured to by experts. And I'm sitting here waiting and waiting to hear what Marina has to say about the history. I want to know why I only heard about this, like, starting with Seattle. And I think that, am I old-fashioned? I feel like this turning into a group go-round, and I want to hear what you guys have to say, because that's why I came.
Everything.
Okay, well, we were hoping to facilitate a lot of the conversation, but we do have information, so it was kind of to put our information in where there was gaps. Do you want to do the Native American history?
The truth is, I don't know a lot about history. I'm much more, you know, familiar with the formal process. And so I just wanted to point out that there is a history to this, that people have used this successfully in the civil rights movement. It was used in the anti-war movement. There were places where it was used. I know there was also some hierarchical problems with that. And I know in the anti-nuke movement, there was kind of a mix, from what I understand, from what little bit I was involved in that, that, you know, sometimes people were very hierarchical and sometimes not. I don't really have that much to say about it. I don't know what you
know.
I
mean, somewhat I may know what came from, and I think a lot of people know, the Iroquois specifically used consensus process, and it is a lot of where the, you know, founders of the U.S. Constitution and everything else drew a lot from the Iroquois and Native Americans, and that kind of face-to-face, so that they moved it to representational democracy. But from Native Americans, different places around the world have used, like David was talking about, consensus, and it's particularly in places that don't have a centralized state. So you're talking about various reasons, a town that's more autonomous, or I spent time in Haiti and in parts of Haiti. Different towns were using consensus and bartering with each other, in part because they were so far away from the government. The government was so oppressive at that time as well. And that really entailed people coming together from the town, listening to each other and talking, coming up with what the town needed. It was very need-based. And then bartering with the neighboring town on those needs, who were meeting in a similar fashion. My sense of the 60s and the civil, going from the, particularly the, not so much in parts of the civil rights movement, though, apparently in SNCC, they used consensus quite a bit. In other parts of the civil rights movement, not. And you can see that when you look at kind of power and hierarchy again, as far as male leadership or, you know, who's leading more centrally. But in the anti-war movement, a lot of that was so heavily male, white dominated, that out of that came a lot of other groups where women felt so alienated and so oppressed in those, some of those organizations, that then you had radical feminist movements coming out. People of color, whether it's radical Chicano groups coming out of it, or a whole number of groups, not necessarily coming out of, but that political experience that was predominating, which was a small group of people dominating politically, kind of telling people what to do in a way. There were some conversations, but people were silenced. And so there was a reaction to that in other groups. So a lot of feminist groups, for example, used consensus. A lot of the anti-nuke groups in the early 70s, things like affinity groups that we talk about, now, the affinity group model was used pretty heavily within the anti-nuclear movement, as well as consensus decision-making, spokes councils, things like that. And they're explicit when they talk, or some of the people who've written about the anti-nuclear movement are pretty explicit in talking about that actually that came out of the bad experience of the 60s. So that's some of my sense. There's a great book called Democracy from the Heart He was a leader of SDS, a gay man, who talks about part of his analysis of why a lot of the groups were down in the 60s. It was because of power and gender and hierarchy. And he's an anti-authoritarian and looks to consensus decision-making. And I will remember his name before we finish. I'm sorry.
How would you just quickly define affinity groups? So it's just a clear thing in our mind.
Does somebody else want to define it?
An affinity group to me is a group that has agreed to coalesce around an issue and is trying to work together collectively to meet a goal.
And spends time getting to know each other, knowing it's about building trust within that group, so knowing each other's boundaries, having a lot of these long conversations about what your limits are, building trust and community in a small group.
And ideally they're small groups, 5 to 10 people. Get beyond that, and it's hard to keep the trust and interpersonal knowledge. And part of the theory behind it is that if you're doing direct action or civil disobedience, and you're in a tight spot, you want to know the people who are around you. You know, and if you're going to have to use a consensus model to make a decision, and everybody knows each other, it's a little bit easier. And it really is a very comforting thing to have 8 or 10 people who you feel very comfortable with around you when you're in a large situation where crowds could get unruly and the cops could close in.
So there's, I guess, different components of consensus that we're touching on, and there's the consensus and the going toward a directly democratic society where we all participate and our voices are heard, even if it's not to do some kind of action, but it's as a way of relating to each other and creating something new, and that through doing that and spreading that throughout, we, you know, both as we're trying to change things in society, we're actually doing that through our practice, being more actors in our lives. But then it's crucial to do it if you're planning an action because of these issues of trust and safety. And that if not everyone feels like their voice has been heard and all of a sudden they're involved in some kind of activity and your input isn't a part of that, it can actually be dangerous. So it goes from, I think, being very important to absolutely necessary to use consensus.
And some people might not know, but affinity groups have become played a really, really big role in the last few years. When you've had these mass actions, what tends to happen is you'll have large groups that get together and come to consensus on basic strategies, on goals, but an awful lot of what's decided is executed by these affinity groups. And the exact decisions in a demonstration of who will go to this street and exactly what they're going to do, if they're going to lock themselves to a building or they're going to hold up a sign, that's all. You don't have the huge meeting deciding all of that, which would both be unwieldy and would lead to all... Those meetings are very open, so there are limits on what you can talk about in them. It's almost a way of dealing with scale. Then the affinity groups go and work out details, autonomously work out the details of the big plan that's been come up in a larger group. And that's where that sense of confidence and knowing each other makes things work much, much better.
Can someone take that next step of where you go from there to what a spokes council is for someone who's been to a spokes council and can actually describe maybe exactly what that is and what that looks like? I'm thinking of the Modern Times Collective people. Another facilitation tool. People who haven't spoken so much, you sometimes just point to them. And then they can say no.
Spokes council is when... somebody is empowered from each affinity group to come together and meet in an environment that's not completely secure. But you talk about, again, general strategy. You say, okay, so we need to block off, say, this part of the city. So, you know, you throw out ideas, but you don't say what you're going to do exactly because, again, it's not totally secure. And, again, you have a facilitator or you know, generally
by secure, you mean you might have FBI agents,
right?
Or group, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, and especially that was especially true at WEF. So yeah, does that answer the question?
What's an example of an affinity group, and is in old-fashioned language, is an affinity group a subcommittee?
It's a working group for action.
And what's an example other than civil disobedience of an affinity group, and then met the representatives coming together in a spokes council?
Well, at the RNC, for example, where Modern Times actually had a formal affinity group, we had plans to block off a certain street. So we went to the spokes councils didn't mention what exactly we were going to do, just how many people we had, you know, that we were planning arrestable actions, and that, you know, how many were arrestable. So, and then we went out and we planned with ourselves, not at the Spoke Council, but we planned autonomously. That's an important word. What we were going to do and how we were going to do it, and all that kind of thing.
It doesn't have to be action-related, though. I mean, I'm part of a small affinity group of women, and what we're doing is actually talking about, you know, we're part of forming this national, it's kind of a long story what we're doing. It's a political planning of an organization of sorts. But we're starting out, an affinity group is closed, so you invite in people to the group. It's not like you announce a meeting and who wants to come to this affinity group meeting, but you select each other and have that kind of safe space of people who trust each other and know each other. And this is a small group of women I'm with who we've known each other for a bunch of years and kind of know where we're coming from politically and how we feel about certain things and questions of safety and all kinds of issues. And so that's our affinity group that, do we do a lot together aside from planning this group? No, but we could. Like, I know I could call them and say, you know, do we want to invite other people in and maybe do an action? But it doesn't have to be an action-related thing.
Could someone give more detail about a Spokes Council? I've never heard the term yet.
David, do you
want to answer your question. The difference is subcommittee and affinity group. The subcommittee is formed by a larger group to handle a problem where an affinity group could pre-exist. I mean, there's a bunch of people who are already in affinity groups or could link up. And those groups all come together to a Spokes Council. So it's a very bottom-up rather than somebody on top sort of assigning people. You do have something called working groups, which is more like a subcommittee, but because those are by definition open. So a group might like have a specific problem and then send out a sign-up sheet saying who wants to take part in this group to take care of this problem or to coordinate this, the food committee, whatever it might be. But an affinity group has an ongoing existence outside of the group in which they come together in the Spokes Council.
I'm going to draw a Spokes Council. Because it's, I mean, if you think about, you can't really draw, but it helps for me at least in visualizing things. In the sense of an A16 in Washington, it was kind of the best place where I saw a Spokes Council because it was in a circle, which is the idea. It's a wheel, right? So you have the real concept is here is your wheel, and you have spokes. So what each of these lines are affinity groups. And people sit in the ideal like this in their line, and then this person is the spoke. And the spoke is the voice of the affinity group. And so there are facilitators in here, facilitating the meeting, and you have the other people who play different roles in facilitating the Spokes Council. And so what you can do is have, you know, 20 people here, 50 people here, 30 people here with one spoke. And that as things come up, this affinity group has talked about what, or these numbers of affinity groups can sometimes come together in a cluster, actually, if you have 50, probably a few affinity groups, so maybe unrealistic. This is the voice for the group. The group has discussed a lot of things ahead of time, or sometimes not, and has to come to some kind of consensus among the group while the meeting's happening. So rather than just being the silent meeting where a few people raise their hand, there's a lot of whispering that's going on up and down this line. And the whispering is like, what should we do? People are coming up with different proposals. And then empowering this spoke to be the voice of this line. This is not an individual who just says what they want. They're reflecting what the group has decided ahead of time or wants now, so that in doing this, you can have, this is why April 16th, one of the meetings, there was almost 1,000 people in a room with that got really hot. and it was one of the most beautiful experiences that I've been a part of, because it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people coming to consensus on doing certain things with all this whispering going back and forth on what they were going to do. And the spoke was not the leader. The spoke was just a mouth for this group. And that's what happened in Spain. Native Americans have used Spokes Councils. It's been used all over. And I think it's a very powerful way of decision-making. But again, this is one concept of doing it, and that we're creative beings, and we'll come up with many, many different ways of doing things.
Are there levels of Spokes Councils? Can you have a hierarchy of Spokes Councils, or is that contrary to the concept?
How do you mean a hierarchy of Spokes Councils?
I mean, if you had different Spokes Councils and they created a super Spokes Council.
I hope so. Without hierarchy. Yeah, do I hope we could do it globally? Yeah, that's fine.
Good plan.
Yeah. But that's just where I'm coming from. Yeah.
Actually, I have an example of, I guess, a global spokes council meeting. The Independent Media Network it's a network of like individual IMCs around the entire world. And I think there's about 80 to 100 of them right now. And tomorrow afternoon at noon New York time, there's basically a spokes council meeting of all of the IMCs of the world online through the IRC. It's like a virtual chat room. And we're setting up this exact same model where there's going to be a spokesperson from every single IMC meeting in this chat room. And then there's actually the affinity groups behind that, too, where there'll be several New Yorkers in a separate chat room talking and then having one spokesperson representing the New York views. And it's the second time the IMC has done this internationally.
This is where we chant, this is what democracy looks like.
can I eavesdrop on that?
Yeah, it's also open. The chat itself, the discussion's open to everyone. Somehow they're going to monitor to make sure that each IMC is represented by one spokesperson, but anyone in the world could.
How?
I guess you can go to a website, it's IRC.
Can I ask that we discuss that perhaps after the meeting?
Thanks. But it's really exciting.
It's a great, and it is very exciting. But.
And then next to you, I don't remember your name.
Richard. I was going to ask, what are the similarities between the spokes council and the coalition? Or are they, like, very different? Because it seems to me like it kind of, like, works the same, except the...
I would define it, if I may, a spokes council is the sort of action wheel of the coalition. You have the coalition can be an unwieldy thing, and how does the coalition come to a decision? Perhaps by creating a spokes council.
Or a coalition, I mean, a coalition can function. The spokes council is the process of decision making, so that in Seattle, the forming of the Direct Action Network, and then in New York when we were forming the Direct Action Network, the idea originally was actually Dan was to be a network and a kind of spokes council, so that a lot of different groups would come into Dan and actually have spokes and have some of the people present, but not necessarily all of them, and it's morphed into something different. But that was originally the idea of like go using a certain kind of process for a coalition and then calling it a network.
All right.
A coalition by definition being diverse, different groups, each one homogeneous among itself, but very different mixture of groups. This being a way to handle that.
And a notoriously successful way of handling it, too, in my experience.
So how do we get there? I mean, you know, that's one of the questions is, the question here is consensus training, facilitation toward direct democracy. And we've been discussing a lot of aspects of it, but part of the most important thing that makes these work is facilitation. So let's get directly to some of the different ways that people facilitate meetings and reach this deep decision and allow people to proceed with the actions that they decide upon. There's a process that you follow that I'll run through fairly quickly and that we'll elaborate upon. But as an outline, in a meeting, after you've done the various introductions and such, and you're there for a reason, you're there for a goal, there will be proposals made from the discussion. People will be discussing what they're there for, and they'll make proposals. And there will be further discussion. And then the facilitator will guide the discussion and then ask if there is anybody who is going to stand aside or block or is consensus. That is, you know, a sort of one-sentence explanation of where you're going as a facilitator to try and reach an agreement. And when you do that, I mean, it sounds so simple. You'll find, obviously, that it's not as simple as it, you know, seems to be in a one-sentence. But it is actually, at the core, it is very simple. Because what you're trying to do is take a sort of a group think and bring it to one point of agreement. I found when I've been in a meeting where I'm facilitating and there's a lot of agreement, it is I'm sorry, I spaced out a little bit, so I'm going to step back for a minute, and I'm going to just let you take for a minute.
Sure.
Because I lost my train of thought.
You do fine. No, I think
I know, I derailed it about halfway through.
No. On the one hand, it's really kind of can seem really simple, but then when you're facilitating a meeting,
sure,
or you're in it, and a lot of people, for example, like we were talking about with proposals, so that I think first you start a meeting, and you want to figure out what kind of consensus you want to use. Hopefully, there's been some kind of conversation, or if not, you put out there to the group the type of consensus, you know, how formal, how structured consensus process do you want to use at this meeting. And then we talk about facilitators also putting to the group what you want the role of facilitators to be. But when you get to an issue, kind of getting to what is the goal of the meeting, it's kind of a nice place to start, or kind of putting it out there to the group if it's a question. Or even just to hear it, to do some kind of go around, to hear where people are coming from, what the goals might be. And then the issue, where you are, kind of defining that issue. And then their proposal will come out, some kind of proposal. And it's very important to do them one at a time. So on the one hand, where it seems really simple, and you go through the proposal, and are there questions, and then you go to consensus. Actually, what more often happens is there's a proposal, and then another proposal, and another proposal. And they're all pretty different from each other. And you need to figure out, as a facilitator, if there's suggestions to the one proposal, or if they each should be taken separately and warrant separate conversations and separate consensus processes. So that's a little tricky. You want to get ready to go back?
Well, yeah, I wanted to back up just a little bit. When you get a meeting started, what you want to do is you want to have a timekeeper. As a facilitator, you want to have a timekeeper. You want to have a scribe, a person to take all these good ideas that you're going to generate and record them in a way that people can look at and see and visualize. And you want to have a vibes watcher, particularly going toward direct democracy, because as we know, we all fall into roles. And sometimes as a facilitator, you're too busy to look around the group and see who's not speaking and who is and who feels uncomfortable. So you have a timekeeper to try and keep the meeting on track. You have a scribe to try and keep the good ideas in a visual way that people can see, and also to form a record of what we're talking about. And you have a vibes watcher to look around the meeting and see who's maybe feeling uncomfortable or isn't getting a chance to speak, or maybe all the men are speaking and all the women aren't, or vice versa. So you set up a structure where you have a little help for a facilitator. That's one of the most important things you can do. And then you create an agenda with the group's help. And that's where I left ahead of myself a little bit, because personally, when I have an agenda to work with and I'm facilitating a meeting, if I have a train wreck, I can look and say, wait a minute, where are we here? Okay. And bingo, you're back on track. So you set that sort of formal process in place where you have your help and you have your document that's helping guide you. And then you set time limits for how much time you want to set on particular discussions. Now this, I'll say right off the bat, is a very formal process that not everybody uses. But for me, I found it to be most successful, and I can only talk from my own experience. And it does help to set a framework so that as a facilitator, you don't feel like you have to make it up as you're going along, because there is a process that you're using. Anyone want to say on that?
No, I think that's, yeah. And then to get to the process, which then you're going through as things come up in the meeting, and you have some kind of proposal that's come out that might be, let's go flyering Tuesday rather than another day or whatever. So you have the proposal, and there's a conversation around it. And it's important, as a facilitator, if using a more formal process, to ask if there are clarifying questions. Are there concerns? Are there any amendments to the proposal? And then kind of ask the room, and a lot of this is more subtle, you know, are we ready to move to try to see consensus? And you look around and see if people, even if people don't raise their hands, that's part of looking at people and seeing if, okay, are people comfortable to move around, or are people looking like they're upset and not raising their hands? So you have to try to figure that out a little bit. And then in seeking the consensus, before even going to a stand aside or a block, are there concerns with it? Are there any objections with the proposal? Because it's kind of going in this increased level of not allowing it to happen. So try to get as much clarity as you can, as much clarity as you can, as much clarity as you can, until you get to the point of a stand aside. Does someone else want to say what a stand aside is?
Stand aside.
It's when you're going through the process of, okay, the group looks like it agrees, you know, there aren't so many concerns, but does anyone stand aside, which is kind of what it sounds like. Like, you literally like, okay, I'm going to move aside of this. It's like abstaining, but different, because you do have an opinion. Where abstaining usually is like, I don't have much of an opinion on this, or I'm not going to put my opinion on record.
Or a person who abstains might have a direct conflict of interest, so they're abstaining just so that they don't muddy the waters. Whereas a stand-aside is, look, I don't think this is such a good idea, but I don't feel so strongly about it that I'm necessarily going to block the group.
To what end?
Well, to make your point of view known. And one thing that a facilitator is wise to do is to, when a decision is made and you ask for stand-asides, and you may have one or two, or you may not have any, to give them a formal opportunity to explain the reason why they're standing aside. And it formally puts into people's minds why this person feels the way they do. And that helps everybody feel like they have a stake in the outcome and that they've had a chance to express themselves.
And to see if you're really reaching a consensus, because what could happen in a group is that there are a lot of objections and concerns, and then when you get to the point of stand-asides, you have a group of 30 people, 10 of whom decide to stand aside for different reasons. That's a real watery consensus. I mean, that to me resembles much more of a vote kind of situation where 10 people are like, okay, whatever, I've been not heard.
I've seen that compared to a lukewarm bath.
Oh, another thing with stand-asides is that, like, a person standing aside might say, look, I'm not going to take part in this action because I think it's wrong, but I'm not going to stop anybody else from doing it. So they want to have it known why they're not doing it.
And in context, just so you understand where this is going, a block is a way to try and stop the group, and we'll get to that. But, I mean, a stand-aside is raising an objection, but not so that you're going to halt what the group is deciding to do.
So if you're facilitating a meeting and there are a lot of stand-asides, you would likely say, okay, this seems like a really weak consensus, and probably people in the room would start nodding their head yes because they're listening to each other and realizing that a third of the room doesn't want to go ahead. So it might be then you revisit the proposal, could be one way of doing it, to try to work through it again, listening to the stand-asides, or it might be that you just move on to a whole new proposal related to the same topic and see if you can go through it that way and see if you can come to some kind of consensus again.
Do you use vocabulary, the whole group, you use the word, well, the stand-asides come to the microphone, do everybody know these terms? I mean, how else are you going to describe this, ask for people to come up?
It's a good point. You know, ACT UP in their early meetings used to, when you would go into an ACT UP meeting, they would have some people who were the orienters, and we tried to do this in DAD, and we've been very unsuccessful. The idea is good, and ACT UP did it successfully, which is, if you haven't been to the meeting before, 15 minutes, you're oriented as to the process people are using, the language they're going to use, and they give you a cheat sheet. And they were so good at doing this in New York for a while. So that then you go in and you don't feel like, what is this little club with their secret language? But actually you have a sense of the language people are using and what it means.
Could you go further into why this was successful with ACT UP and not so much with Dan? That's very interesting.
Dan didn't do it. We talked about doing it.
Well, we did it a couple of times.
I should talk about it.
Right. We did it a couple of times, and I found it worked very well. Some of our members went to the trouble of writing up a terminology sheet, and we had a greeter at the door. And as a new person, you know, you've recognized some people, and a new person came in, he said, you know, hi, is this your first meeting? Would you like a sheet to help you? And also, another technique to use is to pair that person who's a new come to a meeting with a person who has experience at these meetings so that they have sort of a mentor to help them understand what's going on. But it's a very good point because we're inventing this as we go along, and a lot of people, you know, are walking into it new and very excited about it and aren't quite sure what's going on. So it's something, I'm glad you brought that up, because it is very important that as you facilitate a meeting, you please keep in mind that people are not necessarily familiar with the terminology and you take steps to deal with that.
I mean, it's interesting to me because my sense of the process you're describing is that it's slightly different than the process that we use in our Green Party meetings, and I thought I would just mention our process and clarify that it is different, because we would have someone would present a proposal, an opportunity for clarifying questions, an opportunity to state concerns, and then try to address the concerns. So the concerns are stated, try to deal with those concerns, and then at that point ask, do you still have your concern? Is it a blocking concern? And if someone, you know, and then address from the point of view, you know, are you going to block this? ask, you know, are you willing to stand aside? I mean, people who are more experienced, we usually volunteer, I'm willing to stand aside. You know, I have a, but it won't block consensus, but you would actually seek to question, are these things a blocking concern before asking for a stand aside. I understood you to be saying that you would, you know, you would, people would have concerns, and then you would ask them to stand aside at that point. But
not necessarily
maybe this is,
okay. I mean, there's different ways of doing it, and maybe there was one point that wasn't clear in hearing what you were saying, or what I was saying, or what we were saying, that the proposal doesn't usually, the proposal in the end where you're asking for stand asides, if you're using a good form of consensus and people are participating, it should be different than the original proposal in some way. I mean, so that you're revisiting the proposal, that you're hearing from the group, and the proposal changes a little bit and morphs a little bit, and that's the synthesis part, and you're coming to a place where everyone's agreeing on a proposal that changes a little rather than just kind of going through a list of checkoffs after a proposal, but that the proposal comes out from one human and then other people give input into it.
And as an effective facilitator, one of your roles is to take the proposal and state it for the group, and ensure that everybody understands they're talking about the same proposal. And if your understanding is wrong and the person who made the proposal says, no, that's not what I mean, then you get this so that it gets very clear. It's a good idea to keep, as a facilitator, to keep restating the proposal throughout the course of a discussion. If it's a short, quick discussion, you may only have to do it once. If it begins to get into a lot of complications, it's good to keep, that's a good way of focusing the group, to restate the question or restate the proposal. And you'll find that if you do that, and then people will ask clarifying questions, say, or they'll have a point of process, and they'll say, you know, we need to straighten out this before we get to that. But it gets sort of organic. If you have the focus on the proposal, and you keep returning to that, the group itself will work out how to get to the answer. And as Marina said, sometimes it's morphed quite a bit from the original proposal, but it reflects the will of the group.
Is that true? Are you saying the proposal changes after the stand aside state their opinion?
No. This is during the discussion phase of the proposal. The proposal will be made, and the discussion will ensue, and the proposal will change due to the input from the group.
Except there are other hands. Is this still?
Yes, we have that.
Two, three. This is the. What are the facilitators doing now? Sometimes when a lot of hands go up, pointing to people and creating a small stack, so I'm going, you know, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, now 5, like that.
And it behooves people to remember their number, because, honestly, it's very helpful.
Yeah, more than 4 or 5 on a stack is just a bad idea.
Okay, this doesn't sound too dissimilar from Robert's Rules of Orders, except that Robert's Rules of Orders ends with a majority vote. You know, I mean, you put out an idea, people discuss it, and then all in favor, all opposed, all abstaining. And then if someone's abstaining and they haven't spoken, you talk to them. And if they either like you say, abstaining because they don't agree, or they're abstaining because, you know, they simply have no interest in this, and therefore they have nothing to say, one way or the other. And then you'll craft a resolution which will, as you say, change based on what it is, and then you'll vote on it. So, except that you vote on it. You don't make sure everyone's taken care of.
And I guess it depends, because in my experience in Robert's Rules of Order, actually very, very few proposals that started as a proposal changed because a lot of the input and then became a whole new something as a reflection of what the group wanted. They tend to go through pretty hard as a proposal that people argue back and forth, and then you vote on that same proposal that came in. But maybe you're better at Robert's Rules of Order.
No, I think it depends on how much you're used to. Am I used to, like, board of directors meetings? You're talking about more formal debates where people come already listed with their arguments, and the Roberts was really just to do this for debate.
So who is the next
number
one?
Two in the stack?
There's actually three. Oh, you were three.
I have that my question is, in a group that strongly disagrees, was like very... people with very set ideas, and you have, I like the idea of having, you know, an organizing group. You know, you sort of describe the various roles and functions and how you can spread them, but how do you come up with who these people are going to be?
Well, in Dan, we volunteer. You know, people say, who is going to do this today and who's going to do that, and the explicit purpose is to not have a leader. It's a non-hierarchical group, so that the guide for any one group and the help comes from the group itself. Now, to make it easier, for example, in Dan, what we used to do is appoint the facilitators a week ahead so that people could prepare and know they were going to facilitate.
Did we appoint them?
Well, self-appoint. By appoint, I mean the group arrives at good points. The group decides, or often what happens is they volunteer. But when Dan was functioning it's with the most people involved back around A16, at the end of every meeting, someone said, I'll volunteer to facilitate the next meeting, just so you had that, you know, in place. And then when you got to the meeting, people would volunteer for these other roles. I think we have a stack.
I think it was next.
I was on it at one point.
Okay.
Then I was going
to
leave the stack, and now I just want... The quick thing is, isn't a minute taker an important role? Like, somebody who would take the minutes would be different than the scribe,
mm-hmm.
so that at the end of the meeting...
Or note taker.
Yeah, somebody who... People who haven't been able to attend, or you can go over the minutes and see if they're correct and all that
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff.
That's a good point.
Okay, that's...
So there's David, and then who else?
I don't have. You are on board.
One, two, three.
Yeah, I was just going to throw out a couple things. One is the notion of a friendly amendment. One of the more formal ways that you change a proposal around is that someone with a concern can say, well, you know, I like this, but how about a friendly amendment that we do a trial period of this to see if it's any good? Or so, throw something to add to the... proposal, and then if the person who originally made the proposal thinks that's okay, that's one way of changing it. The other thing, what was I going to say? That part of the, in response to how do we decide who gets to facilitate and so forth, a lot of, I think it's an important principle in a lot of groups anyway, that the facilitator shouldn't give their own opinion unless there's a really compelling reason. So normally, if you do agree to facilitate, that means you're kind of bowing out of the debate itself. So that's one way of making sure that people don't accumulate too much power from such positions.
We have two more people, and then I think maybe we'll move to when to use consensus or not and the role of the facilitator.
I just want to know, how do you handle, you know, when one person, you know, holds up against the rest of the groups, you know, and do you, how much time I want to spend, you know, to persuade him or that person, and if that person persists in, you know, opposition, you know, how do you handle?
Really important question.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it we're going to get to when we talk about the role of the facilitator and kind of tricks that you can do as a facilitator in a meeting, but they're more about consensus. But it's up to the group. I mean, that's why I'm saying as a facilitator, is because the group at a certain point may need to decide. Do you
want
to go on this one?
Yeah, just, it's not always, you know, their facilitator's responsibility to kind of regulate that kind of thing. It's more of just an environment of the group. I mean, if you have people coming at it ready to battle, I mean, the best facilitator in the world is not necessarily going to make it, you know, cohesive. So I think everybody has to come at it from a viewpoint of trying to move forward, you know, together, using consensus. So if everybody doesn't believe in consensus, it's often hard to get consensus, is all I'm saying.
But if someone, like you're saying, is trying to manipulate a process or is continually, or maybe they're not trying to manipulate, maybe they just feel so passionately, they just want to keep talking about something, at a certain point you can put it to the group and say, you know, do we want to move on? And maybe revisit it another time, or then we'll get to different tricks of ways of hearing voices that maybe feel like they're still not being heard. But it is something that comes up.
So just in support of that, one thing that's important and often not recognized is if you don't have a sense of these rules or sense of what's involved in consensus and it's sort of foggy on everyone's mind, then it's hard for the group to know how to deal with a situation like this because they don't have the processes in mind. Or, I mean, I think that's when it's difficult to know how to handle it. If you think you're doing consensus and you're not following the procedure properly, you can get yourself in a big mess.
And again, there are different forms of consensus. A group can decide to use consensus, but then in the end, not just have one block be able to stop the group, but actually you need to have three-quarters majority or some kind of supermajority vote that you can go to if one person is continuing to do that. There's also another way, which in a more formal consensus process, when someone blocks, saying that they don't believe the group should go forward on this, they would leave the group over it. It's a really big thing to block. They can be challenged on that. And I think, actually, my personal opinion, this should be challenged when people block, for that person to explain why, because a block is saying that what the group is about to go forward with really violates the principles of the group, not just their own, but of the direction of the group. And I think to challenge a block, to explain, and then in certain processes of consensus, the rest of the group can then consent in whether or not it was a principled block.
So let's back up just a bit, if we may. It just left ahead a little bit into the block, to how to challenge a block, and I don't know that we particularly laid the groundwork of what a block is and what a block should be. So we have the discussion on our proposal, and we've had different ideas, and we maybe have had to circle back because we've asked clarifying questions, and people aren't sure exactly what is being discussed, or they don't agree, so we need to go back a little bit and maybe have a new proposal, etc. And we get to a point where the clarifying questions have been asked and answered, and the facilitator tests for consensus, and he sees that the group appears to be, or she sees, pardon me, sees to be agreeing that we have reached. And I'll add parenthetically that stand-asides and blocks at the end of a process should not be a surprise, because that should have come out in the discussion. If people are that strongly opposed to something, then either they should have spoken up earlier or the process isn't working right. So you get to the point where you have a proposal on the table and the group appears ready to move forward. So you test for consensus, and you do that literally. You say, okay, we're going to test for consensus now. And you can even have what you call a straw vote. How does the group feel about this? And you may even do it with a show of hands. I found this to be helpful when you're trying to get a sense of the group and everybody's kind of quiet. So you say, well, let's have a show of hands. How many people think this is a real good idea? And maybe 75%, raise their hands.
Reclaim the Streets does this.
Okay.
Where did this come from?
And Dan twinkles,
it's
applause
in sign language.
Right.
Cool.
So that, because applause you disrupt the meeting a little bit, but if you do that, people
see
where you're, and you don't get disrupted. So you test for consensus, and if you find that the group has 75 to 80% consensus or so, you may want to revisit it so you don't take that lukewarm bath. But if you get 90% or 95% consensus, then you may say, okay, now do we have stand-asides? And people will, maybe raise their hands that they're going to stand-aside. And then you say, well, do we have any blocks? And blocks are very unusual. A block is ideally supposed to be centered on a matter of principle having to do with the group. It violates the group's principles. If you're an avowed pacifist and the group that you're a part of decides to involve itself in an action that might harm somebody as a pacifist, you would probably block that. That's an extreme example, but just to get to some idea of where you might want to use a block. And again, if you get to the point where at the end of a proposal and somebody surprises you with a block, then either they weren't forthcoming throughout the proposal or your discussion wasn't inclusive enough. Do you have more to say about blocks?
No, I also feel it's up to each group, but I also feel that a block is a super, super strong, serious thing to do, and I have been in meetings where, and it's in part the fault of the group itself, not talking about the form of consensus they're going to use and kind of laying out certain terms and what things mean, is that you get to a discussion and someone blocks having a meeting on a particular time. I've been there and it has happened. You want to scream because it has nothing to do with the direction of the group. Or just blocking lower level things, then you get into this whole argument back and forth about how you shouldn't block. So to lay it out ahead of time first, and then if someone still blocks, feeling, having them explain that block and then being able to challenge that block, and the group can decide whether or not it's a principled block, whether or not in fact that what they're articulating and saying that this whatever is gonna violate the principles of the group, the rest of the group then can consent to whether or not they feel that that's true. So that can help to avoid some of this, an individual comes in just to be obstructionist or to try to not allow the group to go forward with something.
The group has the option of ignoring the block, and then the person, you know, the way it's, I've always understood it is the person who makes the block, if the group decides to go ahead anyway, then leaves the group. I mean, it's not as if, you know, there's, it's an agreement. It's a voluntary agreement on how you proceed. So the group has the option of deciding this is not a principled block, or this is too important, and we can all, you know, we have to work on, as Marina was saying, some kind of technique so they decide that if they have a 90% majority, then the block is disallowed. Each individual group, I think Marina is right again in saying that it's a good technique or a good idea to have that worked out beforehand. If you have a block, what is the technique for getting around the block? Different groups use different techniques. But it, in my experience, I really can't remember, you know, very many blocks. They just don't happen that often, because if people are at a meeting, they're there to accomplish things. And in a group of like-minded people, a block is a very serious thing, if it's done for principled reasons.
Usually, you know, what percentage you're looking for, you know, in terms of, when you say we reached a consensus, you know, are you talking about like more than 80% of the vote? Or
it means everyone feels okay whatever the decision is.
But that sounds like unanimous, you know.
It's 100%.
It's 100%. What I'm saying is if there's a block situation, you may want to have created a formal mechanism to resolve a block. Or you may say, look, a block is a block, and that's it. You've stopped our action. And what I'm saying is it's up to individual groups to decide that, and it would be wise beforehand to make that decision so you don't get confronted with a block and then have to decide, well, gee, what's our technique now? But in a formal situation, well, anyway, I'm rambling a bit.
In my experience, one of the reasons why consensus groups don't come to blocks all that often is in the course of the discussion, if there's a lot of people want to do something, but a part of the group really doesn't, and they're very serious about it, or even if one person really doesn't, but it's clearly a very, very principled objection, that will come out in the discussion. And often, either the person making the proposal, or someone else, or sometimes the facilitator, will say, I just don't think we have consensus. And sometimes a straw poll, a test for consensus, can reveal that as well. And so if it looks like, you always start with different views, and then you try to see if you can build the consensus by modifying the position, by people clarifying their own positions, changing the proposal. Sometimes you can see that's not going to happen, and then a lot of times then people will say, okay, this group is not going to be able to take that action. But I think what you're asking is one of the key questions, because what consensus is all about is about respect for every individual in the group, but also every individual respecting the will of the group as a whole. And it's not something that happens automatically. It's something that kind of that gets built. And I guess like Jim says, every group works out their own rules for specific situations.
This is one of the frustration with the consensus model is, I think, you know, when someone, you know, consistently opposed, you know, the majority opinion and blocked, you know. And at that point, you know, I think there should be some mechanism, like, as you suggested at the beginning, and maybe we should all agree that that consensus means that about 80% or 90% of people agree to that idea or that. Otherwise, I think it will be very frustrating to reach the 100%, you know, agreement.
It works surprisingly well.
I think for time reasons, we're going to move on a little bit more, and then this stuff can still come up. But I would suggest, as the though we don't have a vibes watcher, that like before we move on, since it'll be another like 15 minutes or something before the break, if people want to just like stand up and do a 30-second like stretch or shout or something, she seems to like be waiting a bit. So, you can do like a whatever, a jump, a stretch, hugging. You can do whatever you want to do. If you're not moving, you can stay. We're going to briefly do a Are there times, you know, we're talking a lot about consensus, how great consensus is. Are there times maybe not to use consensus? And how do you decide when to use it and when not to use it? Because I think there's been an assumption since the protests in Seattle especially that a group gets together and it's going to use consensus. And it's actually important that a group decides consciously to use consensus for consensus to work effectively. So when to use it, when not to use it, is there ever a not to use it time?
One of the suggestions, one again from some written literature that I've seen, the joke is don't use consensus when you can see the whites of their eyes. You know, in other words, if you're under a physical threat of some kind, either from police or a group who disagrees with you, and it's a danger situation, then, you know, consensus may not be appropriate. It may be in certain situations, but it may not be. I'd be interested in what other people, other ideas people might have on when not to use consensus.
I've got to talk, but I'll talk again. I would say it would not be appropriate in a situation where, for one reason or another, people cannot leave the group. For example, if you have, I mean, what this sounds like is you find someone who really, their values clash with a group, they walk away and they join a different group. And if you're in a situation, like you say, where you're all basically, you're in a position where no one can leave, either because you're surrounded by the police or whatever, then at that point, you've got to come up with a way of overruling dissent. Because, I mean, what am I, as I said, my experience has been with boards of directors, and the reason no one can leave is that everyone's there to represent their shareholders, and they don't, they have an obligation to stay, regardless of how much they may disagree with it. So it'd be any situation where there's an obligation where everyone has to be there for whatever reason. It wouldn't work.
I think that goes both ways. There are times where it won't work, and then there are times where, because you're forced together in a confined area, using consensus is so important. I know in a lot of the protests, hundreds of people being arrested and using different forms of solidarity and trying to work as a group, because they were making decisions as a group, consensus was key because they were deciding to do things that might put the entire group at risk. And when you're doing that, having everyone agree with what you're about to do is crucial.
Robert, you had a point?
No, I just...
Okay.
What do you say?
I think perhaps in a situation where in a working group, or if a working group is elected to do something, if it's if the project involves a certain expertise that you cannot be democratically, you can't decide. People don't know this. I don't know how to do this thing. You know, it shouldn't be necessarily be open to a democratic process or a consensus. If it's a very specialized techniques or you know, advanced knowledge about something to accomplish something.
Well, I guess I would like to disagree with that view because I would think that if the group is going to act on it, the group should understand it. So I would want to be in a group where
it's debatable.
I defer to
Absolutely.
Someone else's knowledge that I didn't understand.
Yeah, it is debatable, but certain techniques, if a person took 15 years to understand something, if you're doing something technologically oriented, you can't expect that you could participate on the same level with that group of people who have 10, 15 years experience with something that involves, say, technology, or maybe they have an opinion about that that reflects their many years of, you know, of expertise or learning. So that those situations may come in at a certain
There's
point.
Not a right or wrong answer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about
it
people
is debatable
figuring
at
out
what point,
what...
And I actually agree with you because I think it's important for that specialized working group to make it as democratic as well, to make that information accessible. It goes both ways, absolutely. But that's an important issue.
I hope this doesn't sound like one of those things, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but in the context of when you use consensus, you ended the last bit by saying you need to come up, the group has to come up with a way to resolve a block. And if the group decides that the resolution to a block is a vote, a supermajority, say 75%. At that point, would you say, well, we're no longer operating in the consensus mode. We have now gone to Robert's Rules style, except for majority.
I wouldn't, because you're using consensus process to make that decision and to get there. So it's the process part. It's not the vote or not vote. It's how people are listening to each other, how you're facilitating, how the discussion takes place, and coming up with synthesized solutions.
And then the group can go back to unanimous decision-making if after this particular vote, And it's a very fluid thing. And practicality and respect are really very key. How are we going to get past here? And when we do, let's not have hard feelings, because people are going to disagree, but we're still a group who are working for a common goal. And I think if you keep those in mind, even if you have to resort to votes sometimes, the group can continue as a consensus-driven organization and do so very effectively.
So the point of that, the goal, that whatever, of this little bit, was that we choose consensus. We're conscious about it, and there might be times where it's not appropriate, and that's okay. Like, there are times where it doesn't work, it's okay, but it's just figuring it out when it works and being really thoughtful about our approach.
I just have a question. I don't want to belabor it, but I don't think I really understand the stand-aside. Why would someone be a stand-aside rather than a block? They want to have their point of view heard, but they don't really care if they influence the final decision? Or maybe someone could elucidate that for me?
I said, yeah, did you want to go?
I found a really helpful way to think about that is, again, going back to this thing of action. You figure that a group is making a decision about something they're going to do. And everyone is there basically speaking for themselves. And you're saying, we're going to take this action, we're going to do it together. Or at least everyone's going to support it. If somebody feels, like David was saying, that not that they're going to be out of town that week and so they're not going to do it, but that they don't want to do that. They don't think that's the right thing to do. But they respect that the other group, people in the group, think it is a good thing to do. So they don't object so strongly that they want to stop the group, but they don't want to take part. Then you're essentially, that's why it's called a stand aside. You're not standing in front of the group and saying, whoa, stop. You're saying, look, I don't think this is such a great idea. However, I trust you to take into consideration my perspective. I will simply not take part. And then you guys do what you're going to do. Sometimes a stand aside will be very persuasive, and people will be like, huh, that's a good point. But, so that is, that's basically it. You're not going to take part yourself, but you're not going to stop everyone else from doing it.
Did that work?
Well, let me add something, if I may, because I think the stand aside comes before the final test for consensus. So a person, you say, are there any stand asides? So a person has the opportunity to speak about why. You know, they make the fact known that they're going to stand aside. And that gets people thinking. So it's more than symbolic, it's practical as well. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Okay, we'll do the two more hands, one, two, and then we're going to move to
the I was just thinking that maybe in a way to distinguish between blocks and stand asides, it seemed that the block is more radical insofar as what you were saying before. It's like, someone would block if a proposal is going against group principles, whereas the stand aside seems to be not so severe insofar as the individual involved in standing aside doesn't see that there's like some sort of direct conflict with the group principles, but just has a reason for not being involved in that. So it seems to kind of operate on a less severe level in a way.
I just wanted to add that one thing that's important to remember, which may be easily forgotten if we're used to thinking from an authoritarian model, is that when we're working in consensus and as a group, that we're working for sort of the ideals and the vision of the group. So it's not about how you feel so much personally, like it's like in everybody thinking about their own personal position related to the group. It's like the group's sort of idea and the vision and everything first. So you could take your personal position, but it doesn't have, what the important thing is what is the group doing? What is the big picture here?
I think the time, if it's because it's almost 10 after 2, and we wanted to finish going through some of the tricks in the role of facilitator before we can get to
role plays.
That's
question?
Okay.
Will there be time during this, say, for me to, or any of us who in a situation where you think the thing's not working very well, to describe what kind of meetings we're having, that kind of thing, and hear comments on it, suggestions.
Maybe we should put that at the end.
Yeah, why don't we do some practice role plays after we come back for the break, and then see if we can do that. If that's what the group wants to do, I think absolutely.
Or stay late. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are interested.
Great.
Yeah.
We also wanted to do, and we forgot to put this in the outline of our agenda, is to do an evaluation of this training itself at the end so that we can all learn from it for the next time.
So unless there's anything else that's really crying out about that, I'd like to move into a couple of what we call techniques or tricks or ways that facilitators can...
I do think I have a short, valuable thing to say about stand signs.
Okay.
Which is that in our process, we do go to a vote if we don't have consensus. So one thing that a stand aside allows people to do, if they can see from the discussion that it's clear that they would lose a vote, out of respect to the group and not taking the time to have a vote, they will stand aside.
Did that help? I don't mean to cut off the discussion.
No, okay.
Great.
When you do the tricks, that visual thing was really wonderful. If any of these things can be drawn on the blackboard in some kind of suggestive way, that's amazing.
Okay. We'll try. Okay. Roll the facilitator. Can we draw the roll? You want to draw a facilitator?
Why don't you start with the roll?
Okay. Role facilitator, which we've kind of gone through a bit already, to keep revisiting this question of power and leadership, because we're so used to being in hierarchical groups, structures, whatever, in our lives. So when you see someone sitting in the front, or two people sitting in the front, it's kind of like leader, you know? And that's not the role of the facilitator. It shouldn't be. Do we mess it up a lot? Yes, we being like a big plural in most groups I've been in, it often happens like that, especially because there aren't a lot of people trained to be facilitators or who feel confident to be facilitators, so you have a small group of people doing it a lot, and it can get confused with leadership. So it's really important as a facilitator to keep checking yourself and having people check you on what your role is, and that it's not to be leading the group in decision-making, it's to be facilitating a conversation so the group can come to its own place. Some of the key things to do in doing that is listening well and helping to facilitate the group to listen to each other. And we'll go through some tricks in a minute of how the kind of listening skills. Keeping the energy up, which is a vibe watcher thing. It's about jumping up. It's about making jokes. It's maybe you know somebody in the group who's going to say something that's kind of funny. It's balancing out speakers maybe if you know different speakers. Some are more lively in the way they speak. So you have this responsibility a little bit to keep energy up. And then guiding the discussion through using the agenda, helping in understanding what the group wants to do and their goals. Your role is to help the group get there. And paying attention to time, which I'm not particularly good at, and Jim is exceptionally good at. But it's really important in helping to guide the group is to pay attention to the time so that something doesn't get left off the agenda altogether when the group wanted to get to that point on the agenda.
Let me add a couple things here, if I may. An important role for a facilitator is to get the group as a whole to speak. So in any group, some people will speak more than others, and it's important for the facilitator to remember to say, okay, now who hasn't spoken? Let's hear from some people who haven't spoken. And they may not want to speak, that's fine, but make a very obvious opportunity for people who are a little perhaps not used to the group or aren't used to speaking publicly to make themselves heard. And I have found that when that's done over a series of meetings, people then come out of their shell a little bit, and after a while it isn't as necessary to bring the same people out. You're always going to have to bring newcomers out to some extent. But I think it's real important for a facilitator, as a group facilitator, to remember that the group isn't just the people who are speaking.
And other tricks in the facilitation and paying attention to gender and who's speaking, again, as far as the ordering and shifting the number, the who's speaking in what order, to balance that out. I know a group in Canada, CLAC, the way they do it is male-female. And that's just the way it goes. So if a man's hand is, if a man speaks and there's not a woman who wants to speak, you wait. And this, I mean, anybody who was in a Dan meeting spring of last year knows what this could have looked like potentially, which is a lot of silence for a while. So there's different tricks, and the group can decide those tricks.
And then the role of facilitator, as I said, don't feel you have to do it all. Ask for volunteers to help with various different, you know, as you mentioned, the note keeper. To pass along what was decided at the meeting to everybody, the timekeeper, the vibes watcher, and of course, co-facilitators. That's a very important part. And one of the nice things that I found when I started working with Dan was the very definite idea that gender parity was something to be ardently worked for, not just desired, but worked for. You said, all right, you know, as a Dan, we want to have male and female gender parity, and it was wonderful, and it still is wonderful, and we still strive for it.
And that those facilitators, the relationship between the two facilitators, this is why it's really good if you can decide either ahead of time or if you decide at that meeting, it's worth taking a few minutes before the meeting starts and maybe do the exercise like we did when we started here. One person speaks for a minute and then the other person speaks for a minute and do the back and forth listening. It also gives the facilitators a chance, if they haven't talked to each other ahead of time, to not just go through a proposed agenda and things like that, but if they don't really know each other, to know each other's styles, because it's really important to work well together. So like Jim and I do this occasional touching of each other. That might not be okay with each other, but we know it's okay with each other because we've worked together before, and it's kind of an energy, and it's important to co-facilitate in a way that creates a whole. So talking to the other person about your style, or I was talking about, there's somebody I did a whole bunch of legal trainings with, and he and I both have this tendency to talk a lot. So we would have certain signals that were like a way of touching each other that was just like, you know, stop. You're like, you are going on. And it worked for us. And so you just figure that out as co-facilitators.
This gentleman has a question.
You're talking about alternating male-female. Okay, there's other dimensions. One, if you're facilitating and you suggest, let's alternate male-female, somebody may say, well, why don't we alternate black-white or of color versus not? That seems a tricky thing, because then you have to pigeonhole people, and you're one of those, but you're over here, you know. What do you say if someone suggests that to you?
Well, we should have as diverse facilitators, absolutely, not just male-female,
I mean,
but people of color and gender.
Right.
The alternating.
And the speaking? I think you encourage it. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. That's what I was going to say. You try and encourage as much. I mean, I haven't worked with, so I'm not familiar with their definite male, definite female. But in meetings where I've been, part of the role of the facilitator and the vibes watcher and the co-facilitators is to take a sense of getting everybody involved. And while you might not choose as a group to be as formal as CLAC, I think, you know, the group itself should decide, well, are we going to, you know, say male, female only? And it does get a lot trickier when you have people of different color in the same room. And there are wounded feelings sometimes. It's not a hard and fast thing where you can say, well, this is how we're going to do it. It's good facilitation, and good groups will be sensitive to that. And a vibes watcher, you know, it's a very sort of unclear term, but as I understand it, it will help call to the attention of the group that this is the feeling that some people are getting, that their concerns are perhaps being overlooked. So is there an easy, straightforward, this is the answer? No. But it's something, I'm glad you raised the question, because it's definitely something we need to be aware of.
And it's a problem. I think it's a problem, and we should just say that, like, I mean, in a lot of groups I've been in as far as diversity and conversation, that it's a problem if there was a structural answer. And I'm open for structure. I'm all about consensus and process, but I think structure can be a really good thing. So if there was some kind of structural way of having a more diverse conversation and making sure that that happened and that worked for people, that would work for me.
You would ask people to pigeonhole themselves and decide what you are, and then we'll alternate like that?
No. You know, I think not pigeonholing people generally, but to encourage conversation.
Because you were talking about this very formal,
right.
Male, female, then a male, female, and it's not a female, we wait,
it's
just kind of stuff.
Available.
It's a tool, and that group agreed to do that. So if we all in this room decided right now we're going to go male, female, alternating, if we agree to do that, we can agree to do that and move ahead that way, so different groups can use different ways.
This gentleman had his hand up. We have a stack to it, I'm sorry, so you want to be next?
If I may make an observation, just in terms of, say, energy dynamics, energy structure, two facilitators is nice, because this is a circle. I think that's a very important structure. And if one, I noticed that that half of the room has much fewer speakers than this half, and the energy seems to be all funneling towards the facilitators and the proximity to the facilitators. So perhaps if a co-facilitator would be poles of the circle, then that energy and attention would be equally divided, and so maybe the structure could be arranged on an energy level.
That's a good
point. That's not only an excellent point. I don't think we should separate because we have to check in with each other, but why don't we change seats with two people on the other side of the room?
Do you want to do that?
Yeah.
What about after the break?
Well, after the break, we're going into role plays. I mean, we'll go into a break soon, but I think that's a really great
splitting up, and then there's a...
No, because we like to check in with each other.
Oh, okay.
I think
we whisper. We're all a little affinity.
That's a good point. And
if we had more time, we'd probably just do a whole musical chairs, because that might be a good
one. And it's a good point. And you see how we learn from each other here, yes?
Okay. So we're going to give some tricks back to viewers?
Yes. Yes, Stuart had a comment.
It's about the question of pigeonholing. It seems to me, my personal understanding of this issue of alternating genders is part of... It's because when you're... A lot of groups that work in consensus, people are trying to learn how to act as if they were free people, making free decisions, coming together freely. There's a lot of hierarchy in our society. There's a lot of structural oppression in our society. A lot of them are based around identities. So it seems to me that issues of, are we going to be super, super aware of issues of gender, issues of race, other issues, has a lot to do with which ways are certain non-freedoms, certain forms of domination getting played out in the group, and how can we fight against them? So it might be you'll have a group where everyone in the group really thinks that the gender issue is handled, and there isn't any kind of gender oppression going on in the group, and you might not need to worry about that if everybody really sees it that way. So I think that as those issues become concerns, they can be handled. So it's almost more, it's not like people need to be pigeonholed. It's like, it's about being sensitive to what kinds of structural domination in the society you're bringing into the meeting as a group, and how to handle them, how to try to combat them so you can actually be more free. I think that's the logic of that, so I don't know if that helps.
Okay, should we go to some listening tricks?
Well, before we get to listening tricks, let me give a trick that's worked for me. It's a technique, really, and it sounds so, you know, almost new age, but it's also very practical. I try and meditate before I facilitate a big meeting. And that can mean anything that works for you. Essentially, I try and clear my mind. I go somewhere where people aren't going to be asking me questions, and they aren't going to be saying, is this the right meeting or somewhere. And I take anywhere from, depending on the size of the meeting, 10 to 15 to 20 minutes, just to get my mind clear so that when I come into the meeting, I'm very centered. I feel very, calm and peaceful. I'm not thinking about the job that I have to do for my work day or anything like that. I've cleared all that out of my mind, and I can direct my attention to what it is I'm trying to do. And I think facilitation, even if you find out on the spot that you're going to be facilitating, you can ask the group, okay, please give me a minute or 2 minutes, and the group will certainly do that, and maybe go walk in the hall for a couple of minutes, whatever it takes to clear your head, but just take a little time to let everything else go and focus on what you're going to do.
Actually, on that line, in that direction. Also, in a meeting, if you start, things get really hot, there's a big debate, calling for a timeout, having those moments, or so the co-facilitators can actually talk to each other at a certain moment or try to come up with proposals, those are all things that I think are really important. And there's a responsibility in facilitating, but it's a whole group that you're with, and you're part of that group. So asking the group, this is overwhelming, I need a timeout, is fine and actually good, rather than trying to push along when things get tense, which they sometimes do.
It goes back again to remembering you're not the leader, you're the facilitator. And I know one time I was in a meeting, it was a rather large meeting that I was facilitating, and there was a lot of heated discussion going on, and I had no idea what to do next. And so I said, okay, I have no idea what to do next. Why don't we just sit quietly until somebody has an idea, and then suggest that idea, and we'll take the ideas. And it took maybe a minute of silence, and you think, oh, maybe that's uncomfortable. It was one of the most peaceful silences I've ever been associated with. It was great. Everybody just sat there and thought. And sure enough, some very good ideas emerged, and we went on. And it came, in a sense, from a moment of, I don't know what to do. And my instinct was to just throw it out to the group, and it worked very well in that instance, and I have a feeling it would work in most instances.
Which is actually also a trick for listening, if we can go there. That silences, you know, that if it seems like people aren't really listening to each other, asking the group to take 30 seconds or even a minute, just being quiet can be really, really useful. Listening as well, it's the silence and it's the making sure when you're listening to that other person and not just thinking about what you're about to say next and then you miss what that person just said. Other tricks, though, as a facilitator is like the way we began, speaking for 1 minute or 2 minutes and then having the other person speak for 1 or 2 minutes and you just listen for a minute or two. You can also do small group breakouts, which are, you know, this is actually a fairly large group, and if there's certain conversations or certain decisions we have to make that are large, we might decide to break into groups of 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever. The facilitator may suggest going into smaller groups to have those conversations so more voices can get heard. Go-arounds are another one, the way we started, where just each person speaks on a particular topic, and again, then each voice is heard if they want it to be heard. Caucusing, so rather than the facilitators dividing the group into groups of 5 or 4, just by where you're sitting, it could be that there was a little bit of a debate that was coming out. So, you know, the people who wanted to propose direct action there, people who want, I don't know actually how you would, that's a bad example. Caucus on, it might be themes for a flyer, and so people who want different themes might caucus on the proposals they're going to come up with to then bring back to the group so that you can get together with people you're like-minded on in that area.
Does that relate to an affinity group, caucusing?
Not as I understand it, because an affinity group is something that will get together outside of a meeting, taking the group decision and then implementing it themselves, whereas a caucus is a way of helping the group in a meeting reach a decision.
So that if you're in a meeting and we're making a flyer and some people want the flyer to address immigrant rights issues, someone else wants it to address the fact that the U.S. is bombing, and someone else or some other people want it to address civil liberties, you might propose that there are 3 caucus groups that come up with suggested language and then all come back together. If, as a facilitator, you see that really the conversation is having, there are 3 different pieces to this conversation, it's much less, becomes much more wieldy, much less unwieldy. One of those. Much less unwieldy to do that. Anyway.
Now, I'm going to return to the tyranny of the clock, as some people refer to it. I really see it as an ally for a facilitator. And I, as you can see, I have my little clock here. It's a constant reminder to me that time is precious and that people aren't in these groups just to hear themselves talk necessarily. And if there are people there, then the clock helps you politely tell them, please, you know, we're on a schedule here. And it gives the facilitator, with the group's backing, a way of keeping people focused and keeping, you know, I do it lots of times. I know, you know, a lot of people do. Your thoughts sort of run away with you. So the facilitator, using the clock, can say, you know, I find hand signals are important, you know, useful. You kind of do politely at first and then maybe speed it up a little bit. And ultimately, if it gets to the point where the person isn't listening, you step in verbally, politely. But, you know, excuse me, you know, could you please wrap up? Excuse me, you know, you've been speaking for a couple of minutes now and other people want to be heard. But use the fact that the group is there for a limited amount of time and trying to reach a decision as an ally to help you facilitate the meeting. And the other part of that is when you set the agenda, which if the group wants to, we can maybe go in a little more about setting an agenda, but it's pretty straightforward. Before the meeting starts, before you do, say, your go-round, or actually maybe after the go-round, at some point early in the meeting, you put your agenda together, either on a board or at least in the facilitator's hands so that that person can help guide the meeting. And you put times next to how much time you want to spend with each topic that the group agrees on. Not that the facilitator assigns, but that the group agrees on. And then the clock watcher and the facilitator and the co-facilitator and everybody involved has a sense of how long each is going to take. And then you use that as a guide to get through the meeting. All right, we've spent 10 minutes on this topic. That's all we budgeted for it. Do we want to continue, or do we want to, you know, table this for another time, or do we want to extend it another 5 minutes? What does the group want to do? So you use the clock as a way of helping move the meeting forward. And it does seem to work very well. It's good to be polite, but in fact, it's essential to be polite. Otherwise, people, you know, take it. But what I found is that no one has ever been insulted or felt bad if they've been called because time is running out.
I actually had an experience where someone did feel very bad and told me I was silencing them, and who was I to silence them, and they were speaking repeatedly throughout the meeting and at great length. You might have been in this meeting. And it was actually a kind of hostile challenge as well. As you're silencing me again in this whole... And so the way of handling it was more to address the question of democracy of the group, and that, okay, but what you're doing by taking up this much time is not allowing other people to speak. And as a facilitator, I'm seeing that as an undemocratic... I hopefully used this tone. I'm not sure that I did. But ideally, you use a really calm tone in addressing that. And then kind of look to the group. And again, it's kind of looking at body language and signals of what you're getting from the rest of the group. And if people are nodding, like you two folks are, it's like, okay, then that's right. Then I'm on the right track, and it was okay for me as a facilitator to do that. You might look, and people give you this funny face and say, no, we want to hear from him. And then, okay, you take it back. But so you need to feel empowered and strong in it, but be polite. And sometimes people do get defensive and mad, and that's okay.
And I have had that happen where I asked a person to... stop speaking, and the group said, no, we want... So the group will let a facilitator know what they want. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So I don't think you need to worry about that, nor do you need to really worry about having made a, quote, mistake. You know, sure, I cut this person off and the group wanted to hear them. Okay, my bad, let's move on. It's not like, you know, they're going to hold it personally against you or that therefore you're not a competent facilitator. Things happen. So don't worry so much about making a mismove, because the group will help you get back on track very quickly.
And just a couple more tricks before we go to kind of when things get difficult in a meeting, or maybe as a part of it, but when there's a debate and there's a lot of people on all different sides going back and forth and back and forth, and it again, this is a question of time, suggesting sometimes that two people speak to something and two people against, then they might, those two individuals on each side might be able to clarify the argument enough that you don't have to go with little pieces back and forth. You actually give two people on each side a little bit more time than each individual would have, and people witness a debate, and that can be a useful tool. Another one is something called a fishbowl, which I've only seen once, and that was in a meeting of hundreds and hundreds of people. And there were a lot of debates and disagreements going on, and so what the facilitators finally suggested is, and many different viewpoints going on around questions of race and diversity within the group. So people who represented a number of different positions sat in the center, and it was maybe six or seven people, maybe as many as eight, and a facilitator sitting in the center of the room, and the hundreds of people watched the debate take place, and so that you had to just listen and pay attention to all these different ideas that were getting reflected, rather than trying to have hundreds of people have the debate. And it was pretty effective, and then we took a break, and then we came back to the discussion, and I think people heard much more the different viewpoints and got to have that kind of bird's eye view of the debate. Yeah.
Gavin, typically the fishbowl discussion has a focused center like that, and then a period of time is allotted to the spectators to comment on it. Mm-hmm. And then after that takes place, an outer ring of observers summarizes the overall discussion. So it's a way to propagate the energy through the group and then reflect it back.
That's beautiful. We didn't do it so much that way.
I've also seen that where the inner center has two or three empty seats, and so people from the outside can come in and take the seat, or somebody who's sitting in the center can step out and let somebody else come in with either a similar position or something to add to that position, or whatever.
Well, those are the list of tricks that we came up with, but there are many, 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 many tricks that I'm sure people can just think creatively. So should we touch a teeny bit on, and we have, I think, pretty much already, when people in a meeting are acting, whether it's inappropriately or trying to disrupt, and the role of the facilitator working with a group to not allow someone to derail a meeting, and sometimes that can be hard, and that can mean being really firm, especially if it seems like someone's intention is to disrupt or derail. By working with a group as a whole, I believe anyway, that a facilitator should feel confident to be able to say to a person, you know, that you've spoken in this way or on this in such a way that I'm going to ask you not to speak anymore on this point on the agenda, and look around to the room that that's okay. If someone continues to maybe be so hostile or disruptive, you might say, you know, I'm going to ask you to not speak anymore in this meeting. And then in the most extreme, which I've never seen happen, asking someone to leave a meeting for that meeting. And that, it's a rare thing, but just knowing that it's a tool that's available, because there have been meetings that sometimes get so disrupted by one individual or two individuals who maybe even come in with the intention to disrupt a meeting, that your role as a facilitator is to look to the group, and the group has goals, and to help the group reach those goals. And if one or two people are stopping the group from reaching those goals, you can make a principal decision to remove them, which is hard.
This woman and then the man next to her?
Yeah, I was part of a group that suffered from that that malady, and the group solved the problem, and now it's just a standing rule within our group that we have a 2-minute time limit on anybody speaking, unless the group extends it for them, and nobody speaks twice until everybody that wants to has spoken once. And it eliminated that problem, because that wasn't the facilitator's choice, it was the group's choice. These were the rules, and they're house rules. A couple of people left the group. They didn't like it much, but...
Sir?
I guess I was just going to ask, how do you respond? If you're trying to... If someone's speaking too much, and you take an effort to limit how much they're speaking, how do you respond to their charge that you're either silencing their dissent, or you're being undemocratic yourself as a facilitator?
Well, that's when I was challenged on it, like that, only louder. It was that it was about the democracy of the group. And I just realized if we have 15 minutes for a conversation and there are 10 people in the room, if you take up 5 of those minutes, then there are that many other people who aren't going to get to speak on that topic. So you're dominating the conversation. It's actually anti-democratic. So the facilitator asking someone to hurry up is actually trying to help facilitate a more democratic discussion. The person who's taking up that much more time is taking it from other people. And that's, they're acting in a way that's undemocratic.
And let me just add here before I get to you, sir. I think, I don't know if you were here when we did the exercise of everybody had a minute to speak at the beginning of the meeting, and nobody used their entire minute. You don't necessarily need a whole lot of time to say something cogent. If you think about what you're saying, if you're actually paying attention and really want to contribute, then your comment can be very cogent. You don't need to, you know, dominate a meeting. And if so, when people point that out, I've seen people who started to dominate a meeting begin to say, yeah, you know, wait, you're right, okay. I have seen that happen. So you had a comment?
Would the facilitator ask for the consensus of the group to have someone shorten their speech or something? So it's not on the facilitator themselves? Is that what you're saying?
I think it depends. I think it depends on if, you know, you're asking someone to be quiet for the 10th time or the first time, or if someone's challenging you as a facilitator on asking them to stop. You can either look to the group and, again, do this, like, looking around and seeing people's body language, and if they're moving in an affirmative way, then you know you're doing okay. But if people are squinting their eyes at you, or, you know, and it's subtle, but that's how a lot of facilitation is you look around and what's subtle, or people yawning a lot is a whole other subtle thing that you observe. But there might be times where you bring it to the whole group, or maybe you feel insecure as a facilitator telling someone to stop. And so you say, you know, I'm gonna ask the group now if we should move on. And is that okay with the group that we move on now? And you get, it's not going through a whole consensus process, but again, doing this kind of straw poll, whether it's nodding or people...
Informal
kind of sense, yeah. And but if you need that as affirmation as a facilitator, then you should do that too.
And the answer often emerges unmistakably. You know, the group makes its feelings known.
Is there any more on this?
Are we going to take a break?
Yes, I was just going to get to that.
Because we're 20 minutes over time, right. And we're doing a really bad job on the clock.
And yeah, for all my talk about the clock management. This group is really, this is a large group, and I really have to commend you on, it's excellent. I'm just enjoying this and learning a lot myself sitting up here. Sorry?
Nope.
I was going to say, may I, having complimented you, let's see if we can keep this break to 10 minutes. so that we can, is that, all right, let me put that out there. That was our original hope, but how does people feel about a 10-minute break, which would bring us to almost 10 of 3? Will that work for people?
Would there be time to get coffee?
We're in the coffee. I'm concerned about coffee. I'm just getting excited now. A while to maybe 15.
Oh, okay, so how about we meet back here at 5 of 5? Yeah. But let's make sure we're on the same clock. And then what we're going to do, just so people know, is then we're going to break into groups and do role play so people get to practice their facilitation skills.
We need to mention some places where people can run out to, not all spending the 15 minutes looking.
If people know some places.
Really, 30, 40, 40.
I'm sorry?
Good